The 1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 313, Seeking Spirituality, Mormons and New Age Spirituality, papers by David Knowlton and John Fritz, comments by Gary Shepherd. The chair is Lynn Bright. This is a 60-minute session taped on a 90-minute tape, so the second half of Side 2 will be blank.
Good morning. Just a word of welcome on this glorious sunstone morning. You're at presentation 313, starring David Knowlton and Gary Shepherd. My name is Lynn Bright. I would like to give just a brief introduction of these wonderful men. The joy of being chair is that you get to speak to them for a second. David Knowlton, when we walked up, said, "Well, everybody knows about, you know, that I'm a PhD anthropologist. You can say the PhD. I added that. University of Texas, Austin." And he said it as if it were nothing, and it's this marvelous accomplishment. He said the things that get to the deepest part of him is that he's an artist who somehow found himself an anthropologist. To what really speaks to his soul, and I'll try to do this well, and perhaps you, this will give you one comedic moment, if I don't do it well, is to hear eight cellos and a soprano perform Bachianus Brasilianus by Villa-Lobos. And he grew up on the border of Mexico. His parents lived in Brazil. His secret vice, he says, is that he writes poetry. Pardon? In Spanish. And in English. I'm awed by that. Gary Shepherd is department chair, sociology, anthropology, Oakland University, Rochester, Michigan. He was born and raised in Salt Lake City, went to South High School, University of Utah, a mission, Michigan State. He and his family have come out here once each year for 25 years. They love Southern Utah, have two children, maintains their identities here. He is writing and enjoys the writing and research with his brother, with whom he shares his marvelous countenance, and a new book I'm waiting to read, Mormon Passage, among many others that they've collaborated on together. We'll turn the time over to you, David, and enjoy every moment.
Well, I'm going to be bad and take the microphone away from the stand. Thank you, Lynn, for that very nice introduction. This is an interesting and difficult topic to broach, the issue of alternative spiritualities and Latter-day Saint Church. Now, I stress at the beginning that I am an anthropologist, and with my colleague here, John Fritz, we've become interested in the issue of alternative spiritualities and Mormonism, in part because, as is obvious, the Church is the dominant religion here in the Wasatch Front. But many Latter-day Saints are also finding solace in a spiritual awakening that is taking place in much of the country. And it's that fact that many people that we know are seeking wisdom, seeking knowledge, seeking learning, seeking spirituality, if you will, outside the fold of traditional Mormonism. That becomes an interesting anthropological issue, but also becomes an interesting human issue. How did we become interested in this? Well, John isn't here to speak for himself, so I'll invoke him off and on. But I became interested in it when I first came back to Utah about 10 years ago on my way to St. Louis. And a friend who was teaching at BYU encouraged me to go to a psychic to do a reading. And first of all, I was astounded because I'd never heard of psychic readings. And secondly, that a professor at BYU, of all things, would want to go to have a psychic reading, would take it very seriously, stunned me. And I demurred and demurred and demurred. And finally, I ended up going to do a psychic reading. And it was rather an amazing experience I never quite knew what to do with. Didn't fit into my canons or my paradigms. Well, I went to St. Louis and found myself in a very different world and came back to Utah to teach at BYU. And from that moment on, it seems like everywhere I turn, there is someone who is part of the Latter-day Saint community that I know of who's dealing in alternative spiritualities of one sort or another. And I wanted to capture that and I wanted to get at that. John's interest in the topic comes from somewhat of a different place. He teaches anthropology here at the community college and also at the University of Utah, and in his class on anthropology of religion, he's found many students who want to write papers on the topic of alternative spiritualities. That it comes up over and over and over again. And one of the things they struggle with is their LDS background. Be it, on the other hand, the enormous magnetism and attraction that they feel for alternative spiritualities. We have started a research project. We're interviewing people at this moment. We've only begun. And so this will not be a finished report of substance. It will instead be an introduction and hopefully a discussion of some of the themes that I've seen come up in, and also John, that we've seen come up in the interviews. And I find them fascinating, very interesting for what they suggest about us as a people and for what they suggest about contemporary Mormonism and for the experience of people's lives. Analytically, I think this is an important project for one very big reason. That is that in the anthropology, if not the sociology of religion or religious studies in general, we tend to give what I think is too much importance to institutions. I heard a colleague from Mexico give a paper at a conference in San Diego last year where they inverted the paradigm and were asking themselves, just from classic anthropology, what do people really do to build a spiritual life, to build a religious life? What do people really do? When you look at it that way, the question is suddenly different. It isn't how do people conform to institutions, but instead it's how do people create institutions? And how do people move beyond institutions? How do people build alternate lives? An image, a classical image that works is Levi-Strauss's image, the anthropologist, of bricoleur. A bricoleur is a handyman who takes odds and ends, shreds and patches, to use another language, and puts it together into a whole, where the whole is always greater than the parts. And Levi-Strauss, of course, talks about bricolage as being the genius of myth-making. But in a sense, all of us human beings are bricoleurs. We take and create meaning in our life from bits and pieces that have origins that go beyond us, but out of which we find importance, and whose immediate importance is what impact it has and what meaning it takes in our daily lives. And so that's kind of the beginning point. There are, of course, other things, but I'll keep it brief. I want to tell you some vignettes. I'm going to read them, just of interviews I've had, to give you a sense of who I'm talking about. Might help if I got to the right page. One woman of LDS background, who is very active in Wicca, neo-paganism derived from Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian, and Celtic roots, relates how her mother is a very strong member of institutional Mormonism, a position this woman finds narrow and closed. Since she was a girl, she felt very distanced from formal Mormonism, in part because of the limits she found on her role as women and on what she saw as a spiritually empty atmosphere. She found herself gravitating to her Swedish grandmother, who, although a convert to Mormonism and an immigrant to the Great Basin, practiced what she simply called women's work. She saw formal religion as men's work, in contrast with women's work, that stressed intuitive healing and folk wisdom, along with rituals that many would call magic and superstition. The woman I spoke with continued to describe how, when as an adult she encountered Wicca, she discovered that it was very similar to what her grandmother had always done. As a result, through embracing it, she felt she was returning to the path of her grandmother's. She likes the complex interweaving of action with the fabric of the natural world and social life. She also appreciates a strong emphasis on the divine feminine. These she did not feel she found in Mormonism. Another woman related how her increasing dissatisfaction with the patriarchal reality that she saw in the church, in contrast with 19th century women's exercise of laying on of hands and praying over each other, led her to be increasingly dissatisfied with what she called the male-dominated world of formal Mormonism, in her search as well for the eternal feminine. She was drawn to alternative healing and has worked with various shamans. In Native American spiritualities, she finds universal principles and practices which orient her to the past and the present, and to an opening of the powers that she sees embedded in nature and in the feminine. Currently, she practices the art of healing with stones. This includes a heightened sensitivity to energy, quote-unquote, of stones and of people. As she heals, she pays attention to the way energy flows through people's chakras, critical points on the body where interpretive meaning conjoins with sensitive perception of slight changes in energy, and she finds these of great significance. Another woman tells how she was raised non-LDS in Utah, converted to Mormonism, married in Utah, was abused and divorced. Well, so much for the summation. The story is actually much more gut-wrenching than that and long. We had almost a four-hour interview, but I reduced it to four words. Forgive me. She floated in and out of Mormonism several times, was very troubled by her male leaders, had a crisis, and while in the hospital, met someone who was an active LDS, but who led her to a spiritual awakening involving a comprehension of her past lives and the greater significance and meaning of this life and of the casual encounters than she had been raised to see. She actively works for a new age, a spiritual awakening where people in the world can live in harmony as they are made aware of how the spiritual to her is the fundamental reality. On this basis, she has built a practice here in Salt Lake as a teacher and a healer. Many, if not most, of her clients are LDS. She tells how initially they come to her with some trepidation and fear that other people will find out. But however time, they become more solidly engaged and aware spiritually, her words. Some continue in the church, but many others, she relates, find it an empty shell, spiritually bereft. She raises another important theme, however. She tells that most of her clients are women, but that quite a few are men. Most of the men, she says, quite frankly, are gay. Most Mormon men, she feels, are so involved in priesthood authority and advancement, which is where they find meaning, it's an organizing idea in their lives, that they're not very open spiritually. They're not sensitive to the non-reality of the material and to a priority of the spiritual. Another woman tells how she was converted to Mormonism as a young girl when her entire family joined. She was very faithful and orthodox, but never obtained the spiritual witness that so many Mormons talk about. It just simply never came. She was very rationally oriented, but took a class on intuition from the Division of Community Education at the University of Utah. Intuition opened a whole new world for her, and over time she began doing psychic readings. Given various tensions she felt with the church, which I won't go into, she made the decision to request her membership be canceled. She also quit her job and decided to work primarily as a person doing psychic readings. Alternative spiritualities have provided her with a strong, numinous world of meaning. The energy of her house is carefully ritualized and regulated, and she believes that everything has purpose and meaning. She believes that synchrony is not accidental, but purposive. She holds it important to work to create the kind of energy around her that will bring what she desires. Most of her clients are LDS, many of them active. They bring their personal and professional concerns for her to provide intuitive insight as part of a process of understanding and resolving them. Another woman relates how she began exploring alternative spiritualities because so many of her friends talked to her about it. So she consulted various psychics and also alternative feelers. She is not sure what she feels about them, but tries to keep an open mind. In the meantime, she has felt her faith and commitment in institutional church wane, not because of the alternative spiritualities, but because of the ongoing tension she's felt in her life with Mormonism. She talks about problems that she feels around the issue of the spiritual witness so many LDS claim, but that she also has not felt. She insists that it is important to keep an open mind about alternative spiritualities, but that she remains unsure about them. In the interviews that I've done, I see a number of themes arise that I want to talk about today, and that I'm going to hope to be brief because I'd like to have more of a discussion if Gary goes along, in part because I don't know that I understand what's going on, and I would appreciate y'all's input and insight as well to help me understand. But I do see some things that are interesting. First of all, a personal note. I find this research very difficult. It requires a level of interpersonal engagement that I have not found common in research. It requires that I open myself internally to make my energy, in their terms. I don't like that word, and I have to tell you that. It's a metaphor. It bugs the crud out of me, but I don't have another word to describe it. And so forgive me, but I'm going to use it. It requires that I open myself to make my energy open and present to the people I am interviewing. The interviews are very rich experiences, which I can't even begin to describe analytically. I feel them tangibly. I feel shifts in mood and shifts in presence and shifts in energy tangibly. I don't have a language to discuss it. But my interlocutors do. Much seems to go beyond the categories of my analytic training. In a sense, this reminds me of the spiritual domain of Mormonism that I learned from the time I was a young boy. I was trained to be sensitive to the spirits of people and of places, and to hear the whisperings of the divine. When I was a missionary, this became very important, and it also was in later church service, as I strive to know the will of the Lord. At times, I've had very strong and very unsettling, and I stress unsettling, spiritual experiences. Although my preferred way of talking is as an academic, it's safer. I've also become aware that despite the language of spirituality that I learned from formal Mormonism, many Latter-day Saints do not seem to mean the same thing by the language of spirituality that I do. And I've come to learn that the spiritual world of Mormonism is highly varied, that mine is but one, and there are many other ways of being Mormon and many other ways of using the language of spirituality. I've also noticed how that language is connected with authority, so that the language, if not the experience, is used to satisfy what authority wishes. That has troubled me. My research raises questions about what, forgive the big word, is the phenomenology of the spirit. What is the experience of spirituality? What does it mean? Can we map different kinds of spiritualities, different experiences? What are the terms and categories that people use to describe them? And how do those relate to experiences? How are institutions built on those? And how do people negotiate meaning in moving through spaces as they take their own personal aptitudes and abilities and feelings and learn about them by engaging with different discourses and different institutions? I wonder how the experience of the numinous, of alternative realities, works in people's lives and in Mormonism, in the church. Mormonism has a lot of troubled discussions about the numinous. It is a problem area, and there's a lot of talk about how to control it. I've grown up with long discussions about good and bad spirits and how to tell the difference between them. In my family, for example, we were told vivid stories of admonitory experiences with the adversary. And when I was reading Gary and Gordon's book, Gary relates an experience when he was a missionary. He relates it very dryly in his journal. But it was a very troubling experience, like ones that I knew from when I was a missionary, that people in my family felt, of the presence of very oppressive and unusual spiritual things that you can't explain. And I suspect that many people have had that experience, and most people know what I'm talking about. I was told and taught about voices in one's heart, particularly the still small kind. I was taught that good spirituality was quiet, not unlike a very emotional sacrament meeting where the spine and the soul tingles with the spirit, but to an outsider, nothing seems to be going on. This contrasts what I've learned as an anthropologist with what I've learned as an anthropologist about Pentecostalism and African-American possession cults. Their raucousness, I don't know if any of y'all have been to a holiness sect or to Umbanda to see the possession, but the raucousness, just the noisiness, if nothing else, the energy, the movement, the drama, makes me afraid. As a Mormon, it makes me afraid, because it's the opposite of the spirituality that I grew up with, that I was taught. Although as an academic, I'm very aware of how powerful these spiritual experiences are in people's lives, and I respect them deeply, even though that's not the spirituality I was raised with. But I give this example to emphasize why it's important to ask about what is the nature of the spiritual as an experience people have. How does it differ from person to person? And how is it understood? How many people, I wonder, are actually sensitive to the spirit and experience it? At a meeting last year of the Society for the Anthropology of Religion, a scholar raised a very provocative question. He said how he has been studying religion for more than 2 decades, but he somehow felt a fraud. He could not feel what people claimed to feel. He was deaf, he said, to the music of religion. I wonder within religious communities like Mormonism, how many people are deaf to the music of the, quote, spirit, even though they use the language. That's come up over and over again in the interviews of people who did not have spiritual experience, but were in a church where the language was always used, but did not have that experience. Another issue is the issue of boundaries. Despite a strong insistence on spiritual priority in a system in which members are actually encouraged to police each other's orthodoxy, there are a number of issues that make Mormonism's boundaries porous. These are spaces of power in which power in the Foucauldian and the Weberian senses become tenuous. This issue of boundaries is important. First of all, stems from the way we're looking at it. In that we're looking at the issue is how people construct reality, not how institutions police it per se. It's rather how the people police their own realities and each other's realities that becomes, and invoke institutions that becomes the way of focusing on it. But beyond that, let me talk about some other issues. First of all, alternative spiritualities are configured institutionally very different from mainstream religion, in that there is no single institution. It goes from healing techniques that are very technical, very non-metaphysical, to extended discourses about reincarnation, about cosmology, the purpose of life, the meaning of the world, to deep experiences of other, you know, non-ordinary realities. Although there are institutions within it, there's a continuum, a movement. It's relatively amorphous. That makes it very hard to draw a line and say, up to here and no more. It becomes an area where there are no clear boundaries, and it makes it very difficult for institutions to make clear boundaries to protect themselves from it. Another point of porousness, if you will. Mormonism has long engaged folk American spirituality. I find this a strong current within the membership in my experience, and much of what I've said about my growing up has its roots in folk American spirituality. Many Mormons grew up having visions, or hearing about them at least. Some people talk with angels and see spirits. Many LDS bless their houses before inhabiting them to drive out bad spirits and to make the house a vessel for the Lord. We learn to trust institution and feeling, some of us at least. Folk Mormonism, also another point of porousness, distrusts much institutional culture, such as formal biomedicine. The tension, if nothing else, can be seen between the tradition of giving blessings and seeking medical help. Many Mormons alternately go to alternative care providers, such as chiropractic healers, naturopaths, midwives, and so on. Utah may well be as well the herbal capital of the United States. The prominent, and forgive my opinion, but ugly New Skin building in Provo represents the successful wedding of this with corporate capitalism. Evidence, Orrin Hatch's efforts to prevent the regulation of herbal products. Massage is also very widespread in the community. Many people have told me that massage is the avenue to alternative spiritualities, in the sense that people go to therapists, to massage therapists, and while there they begin to talk. And they start learning about other things. And then they meet other people and learn about more things. And so on and so on and so on, to an awakening and an opening. I was told point blankly that the College of Massage Therapy provides a pathway from bodywork of this sort to that of other sorts, where energy is regulated, such as Reiki. The brother knew this. I think they probably closed the massage school. They'd have a hard time because there'd probably be a rebellion. Another point of porousness. There's a space of curiosity in institutional Mormonism, where people explore and look at many things without necessarily having the boundaries, the negative boundaries, invoked. In some ways, this is manifested in the Article of Faith. If there is anything virtuous, lovely, praiseworthy, of good report, we seek after these things. I'd like to explore more of this space of curiosity, to be able to define and understand the limits and see how people use it. It's a space of politics as well, where we play politics with each other in terms of who is good and bad. And we learn to be very careful about expressing our curiosity, lest other people think that we're not as good as we ought to be, or lest they use the politics to trash us. Another point, Mormonism has organized itself rather curiously. It is not a creedal religion, in my opinion. It's much more a community of common practice and floating beliefs, where as long as you participate in whatever the language of the day is, and you do the rituals of Mormonism, there's less attention paid to what you may be doing elsewhere, and people seldom trigger negative sanctions. We're at a creedal religion that demanded affirmation to a given creed and to a given faith and to reproduction of that over and over and over again. We'd have a very different reality. But the creed is extremely small. I know the church is true. I know Joseph Smith was a prophet. I know the Book of Mormon is true. I know Spencer W. Kimball. Boy, that says something. I know Gordon B. Hinckley is a prophet. Amen. That's about it. Basically, do you support the brethren? That's not creedal. Do you live the law of chastity? Not creedal. Do you pay your tithing? Not creedal. Okay. In many ways, it's more, do you sound like a Mormon? Do you talk like a Mormon? Do you act like a Mormon? Do you look like a Mormon? That gives you membership in the community. It's a floating community of discourse. Another concern that comes up with this is the very importance of friendship networks. that provide alternatives to people during times of crisis. When the institutional church doesn't work for one reason or another, people have friends, and their friends provide alternative understandings and alternative wisdom. In more interviews than not, the idea of friendship networks has been a very important one. It's the way in which people became engaged, then became supported, and became very seriously devoted to alternative spiritualities. Another issue, as I said, involves the problem of folk Mormonism or popular Mormonism. I don't like either of those terms, popular or folk, for this. We've got something else going on here that we need to find a way of talking about. Because there aren't boundaries between what is popular or folk and what is elite or institutional. Armin Moss points this out, that things circulate, there's movement, there's change, there's shifting. And all this provides an openness that people generally would not think prevalent or possible in the Mormon Church. I've talked about the problem of spiritual witness, that many people don't experience it, but they feel a spiritual hunger. One idea that's come up over and over again in the interviews is that official Mormon spirituality is the spirituality of men, and it's the spirituality of the priesthood, and that it really isn't real spirituality. It's not feeling. It's not about interaction and engagement with people in the world. It's rather about control, domination, and rising in authority and rank and privilege and supporting your team. As a result, many people find official Mormon spirituality devoid. That's not where I grew up, but I recognize and understand very vividly what people are saying. The issue of gender is one of the most important things that has come up over and over and over again in the definition of spirituality. There's been an increasing perception that I have picked up that the LDS Church is a domain of male energy, and that it is increasingly hostile to female energy, that women's gifts and abilities are simply not appreciated or encouraged. Now, this is a very interesting idea. It's not so simple. It needs to be looked at carefully. In fact, I've even heard Sunstone defined as primarily a male domain, where women's issues and women's interests are not appreciated, not accepted, not promoted. And so the issue of this maleness is part of a difficult one, in which is causing many women to feel increasingly isolated and alienated, even from alternative Mormon culture. And I feel a little weird being of the male persuasion myself speaking these themes, but I'm telling you what's coming up in the interviews very clearly. I want to do a little quick analysis of this because the literature on language and moral thought on gender is very rich and interesting. It indicates that in our society, at least, there are different communicative and interpersonal styles that are specifically defined as male and female. Tannen, for example, writes about a distinction between report talk and rapport talk. The one is male, the other is female. The one concerns accomplishing tasks and the sharing of time and space, while the other focuses on building and negotiating the nuances of relationships. It appears that there is something inherently gendered in the notion of spirituality then, because the kind of Mormon spirituality that has been described to me as male is that of report talk. The kind of spirituality that is focused on by the people I've spoke with is that of rapport, of building relationships and being sensitive to relationships on a very different level. Now, I don't want to push this too far, but I want to at least raise the analytical possibility that there is something gendered in this understanding of spirituality and what it means. And that as a result, this new alternative spirituality opens a door to women's expression and women's experience that is simply not available to most Mormon males. And it would make sense that it's marginal Mormon males, like gay males, who are involved in alternative spiritualities, according to what I'm hearing. I also wonder how this issue of spirituality is gendered and of building communication and authenticity in communication relates to notions of sexuality, the body, and the experience of self in a religious place. As I said at the beginning, my experience of doing the interviews with people has required an integrity, a presence, physically and of self emotionally, that I frankly as a male am not used to. Generally, you can walk around and just put this wall up and, you know, it's like, fine, cool, that's all you have to do. But in these interviews, no. I've had to be open and engaged. Often I feel the people inside, not in the language. And some of the richest things have gone on what I as a Latter-day Saint have been raised to see is my own spiritual level, an area that I'm trained to feel of the movements of my relationship to divinity instead of my relationship with other people where this is taking place. Now, I don't know if this is just because I have a sensitivity to it as a closet mystic or something, or whether there's something there that's going on empirically. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not deaf to that language. I feel it. And so I wonder. But on the other hand, it raises a lot of questions about gender and masculinity and femininity and so on. Well, for the moment, those are the themes that are coming up. There's a lot more we can discuss. But I think I'll turn the microphone to Gary, and then, God willing, we'll have time for a discussion among us.
I'm going to try to abide by David's suggestion, and in fact, a point that we both more or less agreed to yesterday, which was to keep my comments and remarks as brief as possible so that there would be sufficient time for some discussion. Our assumption is that at least a portion of you attending this morning have quite personal interests in this area of alternative spirituality and how that might relate to one's primary identity as a Mormon. Now, whenever I get in this position where I say I'm going to be brief, that's usually a signal for my going on and not being as brief as I had hoped. But in this instance, I will certainly make that effort. As I understand it, we have until 9:45. Is that one? So we don't have that much time. My own involvement in this area is actually quite tenuous. I first came across the combination of New Age spirituality with Mormonism in some of my research on alternative religious movements, not exclusively, in fact, not primarily New Age movements, but in general, these small new religious movements that are sometimes popularly referred to as cults. One in particular has its headquarters a little bit north of here in Montana, right on the, in fact, on the border with Yellowstone in Wyoming and Montana. That movement is called Church Universal and Triumphant. I don't know if many of you know about this group, but it's a group that I've done some studying on. And the pertinent point here is that I came across several individuals, more than I would have imagined, primarily women, in fact, who were LDS, who were at the same time seriously exploring the teachings of the Church Universal and Triumphant. Some of them had come to the point in their own religious life where they were struggling with whether they wanted to make a formal commitment to become members of the Church Universal and Triumphant, or whether they could maintain a foot in both religious communities. But it set me aback. I was not prepared to find Mormons who appeared to be active, believing Orthodox Mormons who at the same time were involved with a very different kind of religious system. Well, it led me to try to identify what some of the linkages might be, what would be some of the appeals for a Mormon in a New Age religious system. And it turned out that there are a number of areas where I think at least some Mormons would feel comfortable in terms of some of the ideas. Well, that's something that if in a minute I have a few minutes, maybe I can identify some of those linkages. But first let me just comment briefly on some things that I pulled out of Dave's paper. I think this is an area of great interest. The specific linkage between modern Mormonism and some of the New Age and alternative religious trends. Very little research, to my knowledge, at least, has been done in this area. And it, given my own experience, it's an area that I have even thought of doing myself, but Dave has kind of beat me to the punch on this one. But at the same time, I think Dave has identified some core issues that fall very well within larger trends in modern religion, conceptual areas of interest that sociologists of religion have been looking at for some time now. Let me just quickly identify what I think are three of these trends that emerge in David's paper. The first is the increasing tendency in modern religions, not exclusively in the United States, but at least within Western culture, to personalize and privatize religious meaning. It is within an established Orthodox religious institutional framework. Individuals are increasingly selecting bits and pieces, to use Dave's phrase, to construct a very personal kind of version of the larger Orthodox religious system to which they nominally belong. So this is not exclusively a Mormon phenomenon by any means at all. This fits within a much larger trend in modern religion, the privatization of religious meaning. A second larger trend that David has identified within this particular focus on Mormonism is the relationship of women to religion, to official, formal, institutionalized religion. Increasingly, women are more likely than men to be involved in alternative religious activity. Activity in which women see an opportunity and seize the opportunity to give a fuller expression to their own religious life, to find a way to have a religious status that is fully legitimate and in fact may assume leadership roles. This is also, as I say, a large-scale trend. It's not this is not exclusively a Mormon problem, although Mormonism is certainly the official expression of Mormonism within, as the church and so on, provides a particularly compelling situation for many Mormon women who would like to have a fuller participation in the official life of the church, but find that many of those avenues are not fully open. And so alternative spirituality offers a channel for those interests. The third general area, the last thing that I think David was talking about, is the nature of religious spirituality. Again, this is not exclusively a Mormon issue, although we have our own peculiar versions of this question. Within Mormonism, as in other religions, there are really two levels of spirituality. One would be the officially defined level. And in Mormonism, of course, with prophetic structure, where revelation is received for the church as a whole, through the prophet and through other general authorities and so on, this gives a defining boundary to the spiritual realm. And at the same time, the Mormon conception of personal revelation, makes it possible for individual Mormons to have spiritual experiences, to seek the guidance of the still small voice. And of course this leads, or can lead, and often does lead, not just within Mormonism, but within religion generally, to tensions and conflict between the promptings of the Spirit on the individual level versus the authoritative directions and pronouncements at the official level. And so spirituality, at least in terms of contact with higher supernatural forces, gets expressed in these two ways. And the traditional sociological distinction here is between the priestly function of religion versus the prophetic function of religion. The priestly function is the official authoritative line, and the prophetic function is really at the personal level, and oftentimes leads to conflict with the official line. Well, these are all areas that are certainly ripe for exploration and discussion within Mormonism. I did say that I had identified what I think are some linkages between Mormon thought and practice and New Age or alternative religious spirituality. Let me just quickly read these because time is, again, a question here. But just to indicate some of these that I've thought about, there's the millennial strain in Mormonism. We are the Latter-day Saints. We are a millennial church within a religious tradition, Christianity, that is itself, of course, fundamentally a millennial. Correspondence here with the conception of a new age, a new world, the assumption that there will become a transformation of the established political and social and religious institutions, especially to the extent that these create divisions and divisiveness. So there's a sympathy there. Within New Age or alternative religious systems, there's an emphasis on identifying and seeking out a spiritual path on an individual level. And of course, the key concepts of reincarnation and karma. The link here in Mormon thought that I see is the law of eternal progression. The Mormon belief in a pre-existent life, and of course an eternal life, all of which involves spiritual growth, development, and evolutionary progress, and so on. These can be compatible with the concepts of reincarnation and certainly of seeking a spiritual path. And in fact, this whole area of spirituality finds a number of other linkages. We've already mentioned the idea of the personal revelation, as well as revelation through the prophet. Alternative spirituality often identifies the importance of identifying or becoming attached to spiritual masters, gurus, the concept of channeling, by which spiritual masters may communicate with human beings. Spiritual healing, alternative medicine has an appeal to a matter of ability to exercise an ecclesiastical role, but to actually intervene in ways in the natural world, that is to exercise some kind of a power. So those are some of the linkages. I think it would be important also to identify the discontinuities, because there are many of these, I think, as well, which would suggest that perhaps the boundaries are not entirely porous, that there's some pretty rigid barriers here as well, and I think it would be important to identify those, which I've got those listed, but I can feel myself rambling simply be comments, reactions, expressions of one's own experience and how this might connect to the themes that have been identified this morning.
Joe Charles? Yeah. If y'all want to use the microphone for the tape's sake, please do feel free to come up.
I'm curious where folk magic, as it gets practiced, for instance, in parts of Latin America, may or may not fit into the trend you're seeing for New Age spirituality. To give one concrete example, when I was in the Dominican Republic this summer doing volunteer work, I bought a cat to get rid of rats in our home, and the cat became sick. And several people in the village proposed that our cat had the evil eye, because apparently someone in the village, was jealous of our cat. And so they recommended that I take it to a woman who could, take away the evil eye. And so I did. And the ritual, consisted of getting a certain herb and stroking the cat. There was some Christian stuff involved, the sign of the cross. And then, constantly repeating some prayer, which she wouldn't let us hear. How does that sort of thing fit with what you're talking about here?
Several ways to be very brief. First of all, Latin American culture is very different than Anglo-Saxon. It has a whole tradition of magic that is institutionalized within religion in a different way. Catholicism is different than Mormonism or Protestantism, okay? But that said, there is still a tradition of folk magic and folk understanding that is part of our lives, that in its simplest way is what we call superstition, things like don't step on a crack, you'll break your mother's back, don't walk under a ladder, 7 years bad luck for breaking a mirror, and then goes on to all kinds of other things, from visions to feelings about people and places and so on. There are practitioners, there always have been practitioners of healing and magic and so on here in the United States that move into parts of alternative spiritualities that they adore. But I don't want to go into that too much historically. I want to just say two things. One, yeah, good point. It works here too. Secondly, Latin America is different.
I'll just take it from here. This obviously requires another session some other time. As you were talking, I couldn't help but think about my experience in Polynesia, and the idea of Polynesian syncretism came to my mind. And I've got more than 15 minutes worth of replies here, but just quickly, in Polynesia, most of the Latter-day Saints find that as long as you remain faithful to the functioning nature of the church, that you can bring in your old religions and your old ideas without any conflict. Just recently, we received a $700,000 grant from the Kellogg Foundation for Hawaiian Studies program. And the very person that was responsible for receiving this material, BYU Hawaii, yeah, I'm sorry. The very person, Bill Wallace, who was responsible for this material, is a high priest, had just been released as a bishop, is now a high counselor in one of the student stakes. And we had at our campus, we had a prayer, the regular LDS thing, and then they had some Polynesian dances, and they dedicated the dance to the goddess Hiiaka, which is a major goddess of Molokai, and Bill got up and danced to that, and at the end of the dance, they said, we dedicate this to Hiiaka, not saying the spirit of or the thought of, or just to Hiiaka. Also, I'm thinking about an LDS wedding, the temple marriage, the couple. Maybe the husband will be an elders quorum president on campus. The wife will be the Relief Society president. As worthy as any LDS couple should be expected to be to go to the temple. And then the very, very, very normal LDS type of thing, the pictures afterwards. And then the reception, however, becomes almost a festival of traditional Polynesian religion. The very person who was married that morning, the elders, quorum president, me, take off his garments and get up and do a dance that is not even just suggestively sexual, but I mean really, really blatantly. Other people will get up, and most of the Polynesian dances, not just Hawaiian, but the Samoans, Maoris, Tahitians, are almost always dedicated to various of the ancient gods and so forth. And they don't have any problem with this as long as they retain a very strong sense of activity in the church. And so that the person that gets in trouble, the person that gets, becomes a kahuna, as long as they're a high priest and goes to high priest meetings and holds a temple recommend, people will go to that kahuna for curing and so forth. A kahuna is sort of like a shaman. But if all of a sudden that person gets too mystical, too carried away, and loses activity in the church, then all of a sudden they become persona non grata within the LDS community. And I'm taking too much time, but I just thought it would be interesting to put this in.
I have discovered that most Western religions are very structured. And as the previous speaker pointed out, sometimes it's difficult to stay within that structure, and our dissatisfaction with the religion might come out of the fact that we have no wiggle room or room to go and explore. And my question to you is, what about these alternate forms of religion? Are they as structured because they are generated within the Western context, in which case a person like me would not fit into any of them? But I do realize that a sense of community is a very important part of belonging to a sect, a denomination, or a religious community. So how does that fit in?
The point is extremely good, and it's particularly germane because part of alternative spirituality is the involvement and engagement with Eastern spiritualities. Hinduism, Buddhism, and so on are extremely, extremely important. And it provides an alternative model for organization that is relevant. The answer to the question is yes, both points are there. In other words, there is structure as well as non-structure, and it depends on which movement, which particular part you're going to get into, which guru you work with, and so on. I'm seeing both. Wicca is much more structured, for example, than are the movements that are sort of neo-Buddhist that simply will, you know, work with karma and things like that. So you get a variety of expressions. But I would rather just let the conversation flow because the points are good, and I think you said the best part.
My comments are about power and energy. The only time I've ever felt any real power in the Mormon Church in 45 years since I've been a member was when I started teaching gospel doctrine. And you talked about the energy and how the men reject or feel uneasy about the energy of women. Well, I found this true, but I've also found in a very happy way that so many of the men respond to me, and they look at me as if I've got something to say. And when I started, I rejected this. I'd been inactive for about 5 years. And the bishop called me his gospel doctrine teacher, and I was freely surprised. I fought it for a long time, and then my group on the internet said, go for it, go for it. So because of the internet. Anyway, what I want to really say is that I've only had trouble with the men twice. And that this was the same a dear brother from Utah who got upset that I was using, quote, non-church commentary. The Bible commentary, for heaven's sakes. Why does that have to be church-related? Anyway, they left. And so I've had very good support from the men, and they tell me they've never enjoyed a class more, and they love me as a teacher, and they kind of stand up for me, and I appreciate that. So I think maybe we have to be in the approved mode. We have to be chosen. We have to be called. But I'll turn the time now. Were you next? Okay, I'll turn the time now over to
go. 30 seconds. Well, I started on my journey outside, you know, to find an alternate spirituality for myself maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And the thing that has been the most trouble for me is not even so much that I'm a member of the church and that I'm still really active and that I think that that's probably where I want to stay, but my main problem has been with my family. And that, I don't know if you can address for a second, or maybe we could talk about it later. From the very beginning, first thing I did, excuse me, the first thing I did was to get a calendar. I mean, it was a pretty innocent gesture. I bought a calendar with some Boulet goddess illustrations on it, and my husband absolutely came unglued. He said, "This is idol worship. What are you doing with this calendar with goddesses on it?" And this was like 4 or 5 years ago, whatever it was. And now it's to the point where, you know, he's like, "So why are you reading all this Buddhist stuff?" And it's a real problem for him. And it's of course, I've become a lot more strong about saying, too bad, you know. But I still find myself really ambivalent about sharing. I feel like I have a whole secret life that my children don't even know about, and yet I feel like it is so incredibly rich, and it is what allows me or enables me to be active in the church. Without it, I absolutely could not go to church. I couldn't stand it. And so I feel like I have to share it with my children, but I'm so frightened, and I wonder if any of the people you've interviewed have had that problem.
Yes, they have, but we'll talk.
Well, now, a lot of the alternative spiritualities you're talking about seem to in some way be all of a piece and have a common theory and so on. I wondered if you talked to anybody who'd done, like, transcendental meditation. I mean, my experience with that is that it's kind of a plain vanilla version of alternative spirituality that I hardly think would trouble anybody. I mean, it doesn't have, you know, and I think it's designed to be that way. It's sort of... okay, what can we, you know, the guy who was taking some of these Vedic practices and sort of getting them to something that would go over well in Western culture, but you don't have any experience.
No, I've not talked with people who've done transcendental meditation, but as I said, there are a whole range of experiences and institutions, some of which are more threatening to Latter-day Saints, some of which are less threatening to mainstream Latter-day Saints. I'm going to leave it there in the interest of time.
I wanted to ask David, I sense as an older woman in the church that after you've raised kids and if your grandkids live somewhere else, there's not that ascension space that there is for priesthood members. And certainly when you look at the 12, I mean, you know, the older you are, the more wonderful you are, basically. So I guess what I want to ask him is, when he interviewed women, did women say once they got over 50, where is their space in the church to grow spiritually? And I think if we look at Patty Sessions and those women who did winter quarters, if we read their diaries, they found a survival kinds of things which we might not approve today. But when my daughter graduated from primary, the three questions they asked her had nothing to do with her. They had to do with whether she would support the young men who were her age as they went into the priesthood. I'm surprised any of us about my age are still in the church. Would you comment on what women said briefly? Thank you.
Excellent point. That's my comment.
This is also a comment. You know, there are ways to spirituality. When we use the word alternative, I think we are undercutting ourselves. Meaning, self-marginalization is the worst kind of marginalization. When you say alternative, which means there is something else that's right and this is wrong, and I think what works is works. There are many paths to Parnassus. And I think, I would say that that's a classic example. I want to compliment David and and Gary and the kinds of research they're doing, simply because from Logan to St. George, we read and talk about formal theology, the written word, hermeneutics, and then we are worried about the power struggle. But this is a classic example in Korea, in Malaysia, in Bali, in Fiji. There is such extraordinary infusion into the church of whatever you call it, superstition, magic, black magic, white magic. And the church is a very, very different church. There's ancestral worship in Korea. And I think what we need to write about is write about these and let these be, rather than be worried about other things. I think what works is the right true way.
As long as we can stay in here, we'll keep going. Helen, would you come down?
I really have a couple of questions. First, I did not hear any mention of Mormon versus non-Mormon psychiatry. And secondly, the Association of Mormon Counselors and Psychotherapists, some of them use prayer and other things. I wonder if you're encountering that. The second question is it possible to find room within the framework to be individual? For example, as a mission president, we had splendid women as missionaries. We organized a women's leadership pattern within the mission, and it was good. We found that the standard meetings did not include women. We organized a committee on growth in which we included all of the women leaders, and this worked. Teaching a gospel doctrine class, we explore a wide range of things, including modern science, the status of the brain, how we learn, and all of these things as we apply it into doing the things which shapes and changes our brains because of what we do. Is there a place for this kind of approach within the structure without abandoning the structure?
I've got the mic, so I think the answer to the first question or the second question is, yeah, it has to happen. I think as the church is growing and expanding and bringing into its fold people from different cultural areas of the world and traditions and so on, the church has got to find a way to identify a core identity for itself, but it's also got to find a way to accommodate these other issues, and particularly with regard to women's role.
As I listen, I've been thinking about my growth or awakening, and it occurred about 20 years ago as I met a woman from Germany who taught deep breathing exercises. And it was through deep breathing that I was able to tap into a different consciousness that I had heretofore been unaware of. But this terrified my husband, as someone back here was mentioning. So I abandoned it. Can you believe that? And I've been thinking, I've been like a schizophrenic, because I don't feel comfortable and I don't attend church anymore, although I'm a fifth generation Mormon, and my roots, my people were there when the church was organized in the Peter Whitmer home. I've been there forever and was in the Tab Choir for 17 years, where I awakened also to a different reality. And so now I'm going back to my breathing. Because what it does is open you to a, I guess the best way to describe it, the reason my husband was frightened was because he said, "You're growing away from me." And I thought, that's interesting. But it was like I was tapping into a resource so much older and wiser than I was. And I was literally thinking about things that I would never have thought of before. It was something that enriched it got me in touch with something, maybe infinite intelligence, something that was beyond my normal plane of understanding. And I think the tragedy of today is that we are all cloned to follow the leader. And so therefore, we're following an outside source, which is one-dimensional, instead of an inside source, which is multi-dimensional, which is creativity, its expansiveness, its understanding
and helping us communicate and understand with religions. As I've traveled all over the world, I thought they're just like us. Instead of the enemy without, it's the friend within. It's the, and there's so much more to learn. Instead of trying to clone the rest of the world to meet the Wasatch front mentality, I'm appalled to watch them sit with their folded arms and study about the crossing of the plains of the pioneers. Ye gods, how could the Japanese be interested in that? It's so insane. And then to be limited to with our vision to one person who has this ability to tap into the Creator. We are all divine offspring, and we need to share that with one another and love one another. And the answer is within, not without.
Thank you very much. The end.